Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, hello everyone and welcome to this episode of Naylor's Natter. Now, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Rebecca Allen. So, Becky, welcome to Naylor's Natter.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, and we're going to be talking about the John Catt book, which is The Next Big Thing in School Improvement. So that's authored by Becky, Matthew Evans, who's been a previous guest on the podcast, and Ben White. So before we get into the book, Becky, if we could, for those of listeners that are not familiar with your work, and I'm sure that the vast, vast majority of listeners are, could you just give us a little potted history of your career to this point, please?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so I was a secondary school teacher. I taught economics and business studies, but that was over 15 years ago now. And since then, I've been working as an academic in the field of education, really trying to look at what happens in schools when governments try to get them to do things and looking at how they respond to that. And it's often not quite in the ways that government intends. I've spent time out of academia. First, I went on a secondment to set up something called Education Data Lab, which is still very much around, writing and blogging about the state of the education system using lots of great large data sets. And more recently, in 2017, along with Laura McInerney, we started an app that is called TeacherTap. And we have been since then surveying teachers every single day, trying to learn what's going on in the education system, what teachers think about things, what their lives are like. And at the moment, we have about 8,000 teachers answering questions for us every day. So that's what I do at the moment. And I still have a small little bit of an academic role down at the University of Brighton, which is near where I live.
Fantastic. And one of my proudest possessions, Becky, is still my TeacherTap badge, because I featured quite a while ago now on a piece that I'd written, and it was one of the proudest things I've got. And I've still got that attached to the jacket that I wear for duty in school, and I'd often get asked about that. So,
that's wonderful. That. I don't have a TeacherTap badge, and my streak on TeacherTap is absolutely terrible, so I'm ashamed to say.
Okay, so let's get into the book. So as I said, the book is The Next Big Thing in School Improvement. So one of the quotes in the introduction is, how we view a school is determined by our relation to it. And the strength of this book is the difference between the perspectives of the different authors. So tell the listener a little bit more about what perspectives you brought to this and about the book's structure.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the repeating themes of our book is really that the complexity of the schooling system is more than one person alone can grasp. And I suppose that was one of the justifications of the three of us coming together as a teacher and a head and a policy analyst to write about schools. But I think we might be unique in deciding to write an education book, not really about what we know, but rather about what we felt we didn't know about what schools were. This kind of ignorance about the school system, or in the book we call it our knowledge, persuading people we should be open and map the terrain of what we don't know about schools, really was the motivation for each of us writing this book. I mean, so for me personally, I first started kind of realizing and thinking, not only do we not know what school improvement is or how it works, but I also personally couldn't work out what research we should be doing to find out how school improvement works. And I thought that right back in 2018. In 2018, I'd returned back to the Institute of Education in London, where I'd spent most of my academic career, to run a research centre. And I was told the centre had to be called the Centre for Education Improvement Science. And that became a bit of a problem for me, because I just really couldn't quite work out what that was and what research we should be doing. And it was later that year in 2018 that Ben White and I got to know each other. And so Ben was a secondary school teacher, and he sat on the DfE working group that I was chairing into. It was called Making Data Work in Schools. And he'd got there because he had been blogging about the frustrating experience he'd had of just being a teacher in charge of data at a school. And we continued just talking and writing together in the hope that between us, we would work out how to give schools good advice about the role of data in schools. And in the end, we decided that giving advice on data was, well, firstly, not possible. Not possible in the sense that there was no research or route to demonstrating best practice. But it also was potentially irrelevant, in that really most data that's used in schools has no plausible impact on the thing we care about, which is kids' learning stuff. And that then led us to think, well, why is it that we're obsessing about data? Why is it that data has become so important in schools? And that led us to thinking about these policy fads that we end up writing about in the book. So that's how I got to know Ben and we started writing together. But entirely separately, Matt Evans, who's a head out in Gloucestershire, had been writing about school leadership, what school leadership was, what school leadership wasn't. And that led him to start writing stuff about the complexity of the education system. That's when we started noticing we had overlapping interests in this weird thing called school improvement. And we decided to start writing a book together. We decided to start writing a book together back in March 2020 when we all met at Research Ed in Birmingham. And little did we know at the time that we were a mere, I think, couple of weeks away from lockdown and that we would end up having to write this entire book without seeing each other and having to write it on Zoom. So it was, you know, quite a weird experience. But, you know, the book is probably, I think some people would say, quite eclectic. And I think that reflects the fact we have really different roles within the education system. We also have really different kind of subject disciplinary backgrounds and interests. But I suppose we're united in kind of believing that the two things that we talk about in the book, like the fads in school improvement policy that go on, these policy waves or fads, and then also the second phenomenon, which is the individual school leaders that have a tendency to do things that sometimes aren't very useful or don't make a lot of sense. We think both of these things are happening because there's fundamental features in our education system that mean it's not very amenable to being fixed. And we talk about these in the book as being, firstly, that there's two fundamental problems in modern schooling that just can't be solved. One is the invisibility of learning. It's really difficult for us to observe processes or outcomes within schools. And the second is that we need to cater for an incredibly diverse set of needs within the classroom. The lockstep problem means it's very difficult for us to decide what the best thing is to do for a class because we can't deal with individual children. And then also the other fundamental problem is just that the system is really complex. By complex, we mean it's interconnected. It's an interdependent system. It has feedback loops. It has long-run outcomes that are often not observed. It's occupied by millions of teachers, pupils who are all doing diverse things. They're quite unique, all adapting their behavior constantly to the behaviors of others. And therefore, mechanisms within schools are quite probabilistic rather than deterministic. It's hard for us to predict what's going to happen within the system. When we try to implement a program, for example, across 10 different schools, we end up with 10 different versions of the program. And as a consequence, we end up with 10 different outcomes. So we're constantly within the education system trying to find kind of large scale overarching solutions to problems. But the education system is just isn't very amenable to being fixed in that way. And that means we're constantly destined to overpromise and underdeliver.
Absolutely. And it's such an important book. And obviously, you mentioned the context in which it was written. And this next question kind of links into that. So if those running a school were to truly appreciate how complex the task ahead was, and I would argue now, Becky, particularly at this point, they would never dare change anything. So how does the reader or the listener in this case embrace that messy and imperfect reality of school life?
Yeah, so I mean, leaving aside the issue of leadership decisions that maybe we'll come on to later, like, what does it feel like to work in a complex system where we don't really know a lot of the time why we're doing things and we don't have the scientific evidence to tell us what we should be doing? So we talk in the book, for example, about the ambiguity of like, how should morning registration work? What are staff meetings for? What's the role of assemblies? What's the goal of a parent's evening? Why do kids wear uniform? How should we use, why don't we use our first names with students? What makes a good homework activity? All of these things are questions it's quite hard to answer. And yet we do just get on and do things. And so how does it feel to not fully understand the why we do things the way we do them? Well, the weird thing is that mostly it feels fine because we rely on regularities and those are the way we've always done things around here. And this usually works really well in a sense, like the system knows more than we do about why it's emerged to be the way it is. And we disrupt it at our peril, I think. But also as teachers, of course, we rely on all our habits and automated behavior. We do a lot of the things we do without making conscious decisions, and we have to do that because the act of teaching is so enormously complex. You're having to make hundreds of thousands of micro decisions being made in the classroom all the time, that the only way we can do the job is to acquire this ability to act without having to actually think. And that feeling fine works a lot of the time, and sometimes it breaks down, and it breaks down for a few reasons. It breaks down, of course, during a pandemic, where suddenly all of those regularities of the way we do things around here get broken overnight, and we suddenly have to think in an entirely new system, like, what is the point? What is schooling for? What is it that we should be delivering? And that's really tough and makes us feel uncomfortable. But even during, I think, normal school existence, there's times we feel uncomfortable because deep down, we feel like the things we might be being asked to do are somewhat impossible. We don't necessarily want to admit it. I think some of the root causes are these fundamental problems in schooling. So if we take like the invisibility of learning and the consequences of it, well, we know we're supposed to be teaching responsively, you know, constantly assessing what students know, adjusting our instruction accordingly. And we all like to pretend we're doing it. And yet the pure version of that is just utterly impractical, because we've got lessons to plan. We've got to perhaps learn things or relearn them in advance in ourselves. We've got to photocopy resources and so on. And it's also impossible because actually measuring exactly what 30 minds inside a classroom know at any point in time is really an impossible job. Another thing that just makes us feel uncomfortable is this thing that in the book we call the lockstep problem. And we call it the lockstep problem because that was the name given to it by a US academic who's now died, called Seymour B. Saracen. And we took it from this quote where he said, a graded school system taking a new crop of children every year at 5 to 6 years of age, moving them through their studies in lockstep fashion till graduation, makes an assumption about the equality, motivation and performance for children of similar age that the reality of individual differences rudely challenges. So it simply isn't possible to address the needs of each individual child in the classroom in the way that, for example, a tutorial model can. And that makes us feel uncomfortable. And then also, I think for leaders in particular, they get uncomfortable when their naive or imagined view of how the system works clashes with reality. We give the example of things like new senior leaders, you know, come in and they design sleek systems which they believe will be followed by all and deliver greater efficiency within the school. And then only to discover that the old imperfect system, well, it had the benefit people understood it and used it consistently. And that, you know, makes them feel uncomfortable because it clashes with their kind of imagined view of what the school should be like.
Absolutely. And I can think of a few examples of things like that. Although sometimes, Becky, the point of this podcast is not for me to share individual examples of that. But, you know, I can entirely sympathize with that. I moved into deputy headship in the middle, well, just on the cusp of the pandemic. So I started in January 2020. Exactly that, into a school that was really making a lot of progress, doing a lot of good things in around the areas particularly I was responsible for. And I did have a vision and a kind of ideal of what I would like to do. But, you know, fortunately and sensibly, I kind of stuck back and had a look at what the systems looked like first before doing anything particularly with them. And then obviously everything was ripped up and started again there. And perhaps we'll come on to this later on. I wonder whether now, for school leaders who are listening, whether some of the things that rapidly change within the lockdowns and the partial school closures and then were subsequently adopted as procedures and now showing signs that perhaps aren't working as well. And I can think of things around lineups and you know, all the virtual assemblies and things like that that maybe don't work as well and currently, and almost like you were saying, they're going back to that old imperfect system again, because actually there's a reason why it worked for so long.
Yeah, and I think Parents' Evenings is another good example of that, that online Parents' Evenings were definitely a great fix during the pandemic. And yet, and many parents, many parents prefer them, not least that, you know, when your kids are young, the babysitting costs of having to get a babysitter in so you can go out for a 10-minute appointment at a school are pretty high, actually. But many schools are going back to these face-to-face appointments. And ultimately, I think there is a reason for that. And it's not just because some households don't have, you know, a good internet connection at home, although all of that is true. It's actually that there is some sort of benefit for the teacher and the parents to see each other face-to-face, to look at each other in the eye and have a slightly different kind of conversation to the conversation you can have online. So, yeah, it's but you know, sometimes there aren't obvious answers to exactly what it's the best thing to do and why you should do it, and parents' evening is a good example of that. We could argue the toss either way, couldn't we?
We definitely could. Okay, so we move into chapter two, and you look at mapping the territory, and we've all experienced that launch and implementation of some new program, and it seems to be, this is a conversation I had with Mark McCourt years ago about, you know, it's always that cycle of, well, we start in September, we must launch something, we must do something new then. So this new program or other. So how often are these programs merely solutions looking for problems? And should these programs look at more, as you say in the book, well-defined, discrete differences rather than, you know, huge whole school programs?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I think it relates to the programs that have been conducted as part of research studies, as part of these massive randomized controlled trials that I'm sure many of your listeners will have been part of. And the idea of that is that you take a well-defined program and you ask a load of schools whether they'd like to do it. You randomize so half of them do, and then you look at outcomes. And what's been fascinating watching those go on, and in fact, you know, being part of them as a researcher, and something that I really didn't expect, is that most of the reports on the Education Endowment Foundation's website report what's known in the trade as a null effect. In other words, the experimenters didn't manage to find that students who'd had this new program imposed on them learnt more than just the business as normal schools. I suspect it's also true that most individual things that senior leaders introduce in schools produce a similar null effect for a variety of different reasons. Either they don't really happen in schools, perhaps the teachers pretend they're doing it on the surface, or they get done, but learning doesn't change that much, and then perhaps they quietly get dropped after a while. What does this mean to us? You know, we're trying to do things either as researchers at systematically scale or either as senior leaders, and attainment doesn't seem to change. And I think there's one set of people say, well, maybe that just means current practice is kind of as good as it gets and we should be happy with the status quo. And I don't really see it that way. I think in both cases, the case of the researcher kind of trying to drop a program on a school and the senior leadership team trying to do the same to their school, they don't recognize the complexity of what they're asking the system to do. Because when we work within complex systems where we have lots and lots of embedded practice and habits, like, change takes time. But not only change takes time, when we drop interventions on schools, they can have quite an indeterminate effect. And that's because when you drop an intervention onto a complex environment, it's necessarily true that the intervention has to morph, it has to adapt to try and fit into the existing practice of who the schools are. Which is fine, but what that then means is that programs look very different depending on the environment that they've been placed into. And for researchers, that means that actually the effects of the intervention are going to entirely be a function of the environment of the school itself. So when we talk about this idea that such and such a program either works or doesn't work on average, well, what does the average mean, given that the particular circumstances of the school is likely to determine whether it's successful or not? We talk a bit about, at the end of the book, about saying, you know, it's better to think about school improvement in terms of these well-defined, discrete things you can do in schools rather than whole school improvement programs. And we say that because we're skeptical that it's possible, given complexity, to enact whole school improvement programs that are going to have your predicted effects on the system. And by contrast, by taking something that's very well defined and discrete, there's a better chance that you're actually going to be able to embed it in the school as some sort of practice. To give like one example of something, like one of the few examples I think nationally of us attempting to do something and managing to do it successfully, is that we have managed to implement phonics into primary schools, and we've disrupted the way that the teaching of reading takes place in reception class, in year one, and in year two to some extent too. But what it took for us to do that, and all we were trying to do, was disrupt 3 year groups for about 45 minutes each day. And that was all we were trying to do within the system. The effort that was involved in doing that was enormous, because it involved a whole load of research that led to well-designed programs being made and produced. They were produced largely by commercial organizations who had a great industry behind them, but who were very committed and resourced by the government in providing professional development to make sure this could happen. Trainee teachers were mandated to be trained up in how to use these programs. We had the accountability instrument of the phonics test, kind of massively incentivizing schools to switch aggressively and to implement these programs effectively. So it's not that change can't take place, but that's an example of not trying to transform primary education or primary schools, but to transform 45 minutes of about 3 year groups within the system teaching a very well-defined and discrete thing. And we think that's the sort of improvement that is possible to do within the system.
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that we wrestled with, Becky, quite a lot when I worked in the research school in Blackpool, was around, you know, the constant releases of whatever guidance report it might be. And obviously then we'd do a launch and a program to go with that. And quite often we'd see a lot of schools coming along and wanting to do that. But this is where I got that kind of phrase of solutions looking for problems, because it was almost, well, we don't really know what the problem issue is or the reason that we're here, but metacognition probably is the answer. And I'm not sure, that, I mean, that's probably a bad example, and apologies to Alex Quigley. I'm not saying that's not the answer to some solutions or some issues in school. However, you know, people were kind of looking for silver bullets and things that were, well, let's use that. And I wonder as well at the moment currently whether something like instructional coaching, which seems to be something that's talked quite a lot about in schools, but could look very, very different in different schools, depending on people's understanding of what instructional coaching is, and indeed, you know, the need for it in a particular school or a particular context.
Absolutely. I mean, we talk a little bit about instructional coaching in the book. I mean, you know, one of the main issues is it's just enormously expensive, because it's a one-to-one tutorial model, right, as opposed to a mass market kind of tell all teachers how to do something inset style model. But aside from the cost, it's not obvious how instructional coaching can be done by reading the research, because the research is taking place in a particular kind of way, because it has to take place in a particular kind of way in order for the research to be done. So, for example, nearly all the research that's done is looking at teaching and pupil attainment in English and maths, because we have to use standardized attainment instruments to look at effects. And so we can't look at teaching in subjects where we don't have agreed ways to measure outcomes, because we don't have a consistent curriculum. But not only that, in most of these intervention studies, the coaches are asked to go in and observe what's happening in the classroom against something called a rubric. And a rubric is a kind of a tick list of things you should be seeing in the classroom. And the reason why they do that is that in order to do an intervention study, a large-scale experimental study across, you know, lots and lots of schools, you need consistency of the thing, the program. So you can't just take a load of expert coaches and say, you're the experts, we don't know what you do, off you go and do it, because, well, we don't know what they do and they might be all doing different things. Instead, we have to say, we are going to train you to do instructional coaching in a particular type of way and to look for particular types of things in the classroom and to work on particular types of things with teachers as part of the study. Now, that doesn't mean that as you as a school should go and do that. So that doesn't mean that if one of your senior leadership team wants to become an instructional coach, they should walk into the classroom with a rubric that means that they've got a tick list of things that they're checking are going on in the classroom. It just means that that was what happened as part of the research study. But as we all know, because teaching is so diverse and complex, like, there's loads of downsides of having rubrics, because actually it can lead to quite skewed and unhelpful judgments often on what's going on in classrooms.
Absolutely. And what it can lead to as well is then, you know, busy senior leaders, particularly at this time, buying in packaged programs, you know, from various different providers, some of, you know, whom I'm sure are really, really good and really useful for their schools. But, you know, they don't have necessarily the control over that. They just think, well, instructional coaching is the thing we should be doing. So we'll buy this, we'll put it on for an inset, we'll do a little bit of training and let's see if it does any good.
Yeah. And, you know, the first question to ask when you're thinking about proactive things to help teachers improve is just, one, do they have the capacity to do it? There's lots of teachers at different times of their lives for different sets of reasons, professional and personal, who don't have the capacity to engage in systematic processes to improve with teaching. And you shouldn't give them to them because they won't work. And that's actually fine. And that's inevitable in a system. But also, do they feel motivated to learn in this way and to get better in this way? What's interesting is, like, when you go out and just talk to, like, real life teachers and you say to them, you know, you seem to be a really good teacher. And they say, yeah, I'm really happy with the way I teach. I feel like I've just got so much better over the last 10 years. And I look back, you know, the way I taught 10 years ago, and I'm slightly horrified. And you say, how did you get better at teaching? Well, what you never hear as an answer is, I had instructional coaching, or I went on a course, or I did some CPD. What you usually hear is a story of how they on their own decided that this was something that they really wanted to do. And they went through a process of inquiry on their own, perhaps with their peers, talking about it and watching them and so on. So I find this kind of curious. I'm not saying that professional development doesn't or can't work, but I find it interesting within the system that it hasn't been the most typical way that teachers have, you know, managed to improve, at least to date.
No, it's very interesting. Absolutely. Okay, so we're going to go back to talk about data, Becky, if that's okay now. So
sure.
Just tell listeners about the journey from peak data. And I think, you know, teachers of my particular vintage certainly remember peak data, to doubting data and why great big spreadsheets seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah, so, I mean, why do some new ideas wither away whilst others like data really kind of flourish and become a massive fad? Well, in the book, we say that an idea, in order to become a big idea, a fad, has to have a motive, a method, and a mechanism of propagation. In the case of data, well, the motive was it fulfilled a need, in a sense, created by the fad that preceded it, which was the personalization fad, the need to know where each child is on their personal learning journey. Well, you need data for that, don't you? And then also the accountability system needed data. And that's an important part of the story, because we really view these policy fads as being emergent from the system rather than imposed on the system from outside. And then the fad needed a method. Well, there were data enthusiasts, there were new technologies, and all these things were offering a kind of credible and novel high-resolution analysis of what was happening in schools. And there were commercial organisations who were selling analysis to schools. And that was the method by which data was able to happen. And then the mechanism of propagation. What you need is key agents who gradually start to endorse the use of spreadsheets. And I think the story at the heart of the movement to measure and close attainment gaps, as it became, gave many people, whether they were policy campaigners or through to teachers, actually a really emotionally satisfying role, because they were quantifying, they felt, and they were tackling, they felt, social problems which the educational outcomes revealed to us. And then, of course, the tech companies were joined in the end by conferences, consultants, school improvement groups, other training providers, including, of course, the giant in the field, Pixel. And for them, data really was providing this compelling solution to the riddle of school improvement, because they worked to encourage schools to create these processes and roles centered on forensically tracking the progress of groups of students. And so it was a real thing. But it started to go wrong. And it started to go wrong, of course. Teachers realized something was wrong really early on, because of just its inadequacy as an idea for actually resolving the fundamental problems of the classroom. I think for many teachers, they could see that data was pointless, but they didn't necessarily have the means or the confidence to articulate that things were going wrong. But right back in, I think, 2008, we started seeing people like Warwick Mansell, a journalist, writing in TES about these strange GCSE predictions that were being generated in non-core subjects, you know, art GCSE predictions that were based on your Key Stage 2 SAT scores and so on. Daisy Christodoulou was writing about the meaninglessness of those performance descriptors that became very common within pupil tracking systems and very pervasive in the primary system. There was the blogger Tom Rogers. He was a really consistent voice of collecting and writing these just bizarre stories of what was going on around data and the pupil premium. And so it starts to become, I think, self-evident to everyone that the system doesn't succeed in its own terms because of there aren't actually credible explanations of how it can and should work. And I think I started getting interested in what was going on, I think as late as 2015, we started Education Data Lab and we wrote a report as we launched that really was showing why flight paths were just a complete nonsense, because actually nearly all children don't move through the education system with a predictable and linear growth in their learning. And later on, I wrote a talk that became part of my book, The Teacher Gap, about workload and the role of complete nonsense data practices in it. It was that led me to being asked by Damien Hines to chair the working group that was looking at the role of data in schools. And that's how I met Ben White. But we're really lucky in the education system that we have this thing that allows us to disrupt existing practice and introduce, in a sense, new fads. And the thing is called Ofsted, because the thing about Ofsted is that it makes these political appointments of the chief inspector. And when the new chief inspector arrives, they can have an entirely new set of ideas about what should be being done. So whereas for a long time, Ofsted was an absolute driving force in ensuring that data was being used consistently across the entire education system to prove to everybody that every school is a good school, every child is learning and so on. Amanda Spielman was a data skeptic, and so she arrives in post. And then in 2019, she gives this speech where she uses the phrase, which is the title of the chapter in our book, The Great Big Spreadsheet. And she just says, if someone shows you a great big spreadsheet, you might want to ask who pulled it together and for what purpose? Who does the data help? Does it add value beyond what you'd get from talking to a teacher or a head of department? Was it worth the time taken out of the teacher's day to enter all those numbers? And so just like that, the fad comes to an end. And suddenly all of those inspectors who yesterday were coming into schools and asking to see the great big spreadsheets were no longer coming into schools and asking to see the great big spreadsheets. And so their importance within the system declines.
Yeah, and it's fascinating in terms of the impact that has then on schools, Becky, because, I mean, you must remember, and I certainly do, the ascent of the assistant head for data. Everybody had an assistant head for data, you know, with an office and about four different computers and sitting in there, you know, doing some great work, I'm sure. But talking as you are in terms of, you know, how things can move along and how, you know, different policy waves and different, you know, hesitate to say fads, but in some cases that are, they are. You know, the current kind of preoccupation seems to be around the curriculum, and you talk about that in the book. So do you think that this current preoccupation with the curriculum will pass? And, you know, you can link that as well back to kind of appointments within school, because the curriculum deputy previously would be somebody who perhaps spent 2 weeks at home doing the timetable in the summer term and didn't have a great deal of a profile apart from that. Just my view, listeners, not everybody else's. But now they seem to be the kind of go-to person because the curriculum is a real live discussion, again, probably based on the Ofsted emphasis. So will that that current preoccupation pass, and what beneficial sediments will it leave behind?
Yeah, well, you know, why is it here? Well, it's here, at least the thesis of our book, it says it's emergent. It's here as some sort of response to what came before, and therefore it's kind of, in a sense, needed and beneficial in some ways. And I think it has proven the antidote to the data which was flooding schools for a period of time. And we needed to wash away lots of the harmful practice that was taking place as a result. And I think for teachers, you know, to refocus on what should be taught, rather than the abstract attempt to crudely codify what's been learnt, has been a good thing. It's been good in lots of respects. I mean, definitely for secondary teachers, I think that highlighting the importance of subjects and disciplinary traditions is a good thing, reinforcing traditions that give teachers a clear identity and locates them within a community of practice is good. And it also has brought to the fore some fundamental concepts that are good, such as, you know, what's the nature of knowledge, what are knowledge structures, empirically important pedagogic ideas about, you know, the importance of retrieval practice, securing knowledge in the long-term memory and so on. But why do we in the book ultimately argue that the wave is inevitably both destructive, will become destructive, and it will also as a consequence have to decline? Well, we say there's really three issues that go on with this particular wave, and perhaps with all waves. All waves are necessarily become very generic, because the people who are involved in the wave as the coalition of kind of advocates who are willing this to be the solution to the fundamental problems of schooling need it to be an all-encompassing solution. It has to fix everything, and it has to fix everything for all kinds of children across all kinds of subjects. Otherwise, it's not a policy solution. And so we end up seeing kind of quite generic curriculum solutions, knowledge organizers and subjects where they don't make any sense at all, kind of phrases that are really unhelpful in some subjects, like phrases like we must just teach to the top and so on. And when we have this kind of genericism within curriculum debate, we end up encouraging people to do things that within their subjects are either unhelpful and meaningless or actually quite damaging. We think the collision with accountability, unfortunately, is just necessarily always going to be a bad thing, because the whole point about accountability is that you have to demonstrate you are a good school. So if curriculum reform is done in the name of accountability, which it is in most schools, doing curriculum becomes the way to demonstrate you are a good school and not a way to genuinely improve the school. So you end up focusing on documentation, on superficial activities that can be observed by inspectors, and constantly trying to second guess what does Ofsted think that curriculum should be. And then just the underappreciation of the status quo. We talked about these regularities that we have in schools. The system is more intelligent than we are. We know not why things are there, but they're there for a reason. And in this case, we particularly worry about the nature of the afternoons in primary school. We use that as a euphemism, really, for what goes on in primary schools once you've done the 3 R's. Well, the answer is it's all a bit messy, and it always has been. But it's messy for a reason, even if we don't know what it is. And so we're in real danger if we start striking out experiences for children that don't align with one of the dozen, largely arbitrary actually, national curriculum disciplines that allows that activity to be placed in one of those neat boxes. If it's not in one of the neat boxes, we can't do it anymore. And that's a dangerous thing to start doing, disrupting kind of regularities in the way schools are, for reasons that we don't understand. And so, you know, in the book, I suppose we say, well, what can we do about this? We're sitting in the middle of a wave. We want it to be constructive rather than destructive. We want, once the obsession kind of dies down a bit, which it inevitably will, we want the sediment that's left behind, the good stuff, to be beneficial. We say, ironically, it just means taking the strength and the frenzied activity out of the wave, reduce its energy, reduce its momentum. You know, accept curriculum reform is not the solution to everything. It cannot be the solution to everything in the system. we should be much more specific about exactly what problems we're trying to solve in our schools, which may benefit from curriculum innovation and what won't benefit from curriculum innovation. And of course, we should just slow down. You know, reform is going to be the most constructive if it avoids just sweeping away everything in its path, if it enhances what we do rather than replaces these well-established regularities which enable our schooling system to function.
Absolutely. Okay, Becky, we've touched on this one a little bit before. So teachers mostly get on with their own jobs in their own classrooms, in their own schools, and have little engagement with other teachers. And I'll give an example there about, you know, a lot of teachers are on Twitter, but sometimes we think that there's probably more. And all you have to do is go and do one CPD session at another school, as I did for many years, to know that what goes on Twitter isn't necessarily real life. So how do we go about changing the practice of teachers?
Well, I mean, it depends whether we think we should. We talk about a very particular problem of teacher isolation in relation to school improvement and thinking about the way we do things. And we say, well, we've got this professional looseness, which is that because we work essentially alone in the classroom, we end up becoming very diverse in the ways that we do our jobs compared to other professions. And that's because actually so little needs to be shared. We can do things differently to the teacher in the classroom next door, and it's okay. But it leads to consequences. We actually often have a lack of a shared professional language. It's hard for us to talk about what we do and why we do it. We often have one word that we use and it means several different things to different people. And then we also have lots of different practices that we don't realize are actually underlying them the same because we don't have a language to talk about precisely about what we do in the classroom. But I think most importantly for the book, it just makes leadership of schools really, really difficult because of this diversity of the teachers and who they are. I think, you know, the issue of should we force teachers to spend time with each other depends on whether you think it's possible or helpful. I mean, of course, on the face of it, it seems like a great idea, but we have to recognise that teachers actually often seek isolation during the school day because they need it. This is something the US sociologist David Flinders has worked on. He describes teacher isolation as an adaptive strategy because it protects the time and energy that's required to meet the instructional demands of the classroom. It gives teachers an opportunity to recharge. So they often deliberately choose to eat their lunch alone, for example. But then also, just given the constraints of the school day, and realistically, we're not going to change the demands that you're expected to teach, you know, for almost 5 hours a day. Like, what should we want and encourage teachers to do? Like, do we want teachers to spend their free time, because it has to be free time, on Twitter, at conferences, reading books? Well, if they want to, like, we should definitely tell them this stuff's out there and we should encourage them to do it, including listening to your podcast. I think we should also think about how else it's possible to be a great teacher. I think in the ways that other countries have, by perhaps being a bit more prescriptive in the resources that are available to teachers. So we don't need teachers to be experts in curriculum design, assessment, cognitive science, and so on. It's possible that we could choose to create a version of the job that you could just do without having to be an expert in everything and without having to create everything from scratch endlessly. And I know that's not appealing to lots of teachers, and that's fine for them, but we should recognise that there is a different way to do this job as a professional. So it's a way that's far more common in countries that have more prescribed resources, a more fixed curriculum of what it is that teachers should be teaching and how assessment should take place.
That's really interesting. And just on the podcast issue, you'd be surprised, Becky, how many people who work in my school don't know that I even do this, which is quite an amazing thing. And, you know, long may that continue, I think. I can go under the radar. Okay, right. If we just get into the next chapter. So I particularly enjoyed some of the stories in this one. So there's a chapter around you should do this moment. So is it possible to share some of those with the listeners?
Yeah. I mean, this is stuff that's very much inspired by Matt's experience of becoming a head teacher and suddenly discovering that he's supposed to tell other teachers what they should do. And he finds himself doing the thing that used to really annoy him when he was a teacher, which is have a leader go around a school telling people what to do. So you should do this moment is any time a senior leader tells teachers what they should do in their classroom with their students. Like, you should start your lessons with a retrieval practice activity. You should ensure you provide differentiated activities for low, middle and high attainers. You should mark each piece of work with 2 stars and a wish. You should cater appropriately for kinesthetic learners in each lesson. You should use knowledge organizers in your class. You should record the progress made by your pupil premium students once a fortnight. And I'm sure that every teacher listening has had one or more of these requests made to them that they have thought at the time, that's daft. And we think that teachers often think they're being asked to do daft things for a variety of different reasons. One is that they're often given generic advice. All teachers in the school are given the same advice, regardless of whether they teach art or maths, regardless of whether their kids are 4 or 11. They're often asked to do impossible things, things that just can't be done. Measuring the progress of children each lesson is a good example of that. They're often asked to do burdensome things. Burdensome advice is like nice to have things, but it means working until midnight if you're going to do it. And then they're often asked to do implausible things. Implausible things just means you can do it, but there's no plausible means by which the thing you're being asked to do could ever lead to the improved learning of students. We say that school leaders have asked teachers to do daft things because they're told it's their job to fix things, and they feel it's their job to fix things. They have a tendency to see mistakes and errors and feel they need to fix them. I think all humans have a natural tendency to believe that we can fix problems, we can make things better, which is quite an optimistic and nice tendency. The idea that some problems in education are fundamental and so intractable, I think, is inconceivable to most. I think leadership dare not countenance that actually everything they do has uncertainty around it. It's a gamble rather than something that's necessarily going to have an effect. Leaders have an urge to seek order within their school, to make things align with their imagined view of what should be going on in their school. And they don't really know what the best things are. They don't have an evidence base on which to decide, like, what is the correct thing to do. So they're left to sort of doing these things that they have to try out in their school. And it leads them to be prone to patch making, attributing errors to individuals rather than the system. And every time you see an error taking place, trying to design a fix to ensure that doesn't happen. But it just leads to more and more policies and processes and complexity within the system, rather than to think more simplistically about what's the environment in which we're working. And they have a tendency to undervalue the regularities of behaviour, the way we always do things around here. So they try to implement innovations which disrupt actually what's quite a functioning system, albeit an imperfectly functioning system. And they can't see that in the quest sometimes to achieve perfection, because they disrupt the regularities of behaviour, they actually end up with something that can be quite a lot worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, I'm reflecting on a lot of like the changes that have been made as a result of, as I said before, you know, the closures, or the partial closures, I should say, and the procedures that need to be put in place for COVID. But, you know, getting to the point now where you're thinking, well, should we stick with some of those? Should we not stick with some of those? And, you know, particularly around behaviour is quite an interesting one, whether they should do that. But that kind of leads to the next question. So, you know, if there is all that complexity and leaders are seeking that order, particularly now, how can school leaders then take action in the face of this huge complexity to avoid any of those kind of naive interventions?
Well, we became interested in the work of an academic called Philip Tetlock, who was trying to look at how political scientists make predictions about the future. And he was amazed by just how poor these predictions were. In other words, within a complex system like the world, like, why can't people make, who is it that can make good sense of how things are, and who makes poor sense and poor predictions about how things are? We learned about this guy through a book that I think some of your listeners may have read called The Signal and the Noise, which is written by Nate Silver. And he characterizes the experts who are trying to make predictions about a future into two different types of people. So he talks about foxes. Foxes believe in big ideas, they construct neat stories, they're order-seeking, they're stubborn, they're ideological. If you think about the foxes in the education system, well, we've got Nick Gibb, curriculum fixes everything. Well, I'm an economist by background. A lot of the research economists working in the field are just like this. They construct neat theoretical stories about what school should be like and therefore what we should do to them. And then, I mean, maybe for those of your listeners who are people who read lots of blogs, you will be able to think of the bloggers who are believe in big ideas, always blog about the same things. For whatever the problem is, there's always the same solution. So those are the foxes. And then he contrasts other experts as being more like hedgehogs. He calls them scrappy little creatures who believe in a plethora of little ideas, and they take in a multitude of approaches towards a problem. And they're multidisciplinary, they're adaptable, they're self-critical, they're cautious, they're empirical, they're willing to change their mind, and they're open to challenge. And he says, when you look at who's good at making predictions and therefore implicitly having a good understanding about the reality of where the world is, the hedgehogs are the best at doing that. And we could think the same in schools, that if you're a leader, in order to make good decisions, you have to be able to figure out what's going on in your school in an effective way. And to do that, you've got to be pretty scrappy. You've got to take a multitude of approaches to figuring out what's going on in your school and what it's best to do about it. The dilemma is, should you betray that sense that everything's a bit uncertain and complicated and that you're always holding tenuous views as a head? A lot of the time you don't really know what you're doing. Should you portray this outward sense that you're actually a hedgehog when you're a leader? Well, no, we say you shouldn't. You have to kind of channel and constantly feel like a hedgehog internally, holding ideas lightly, constantly looking out and try to work out what's going on. But at the same time, you can portray an outward, you know, view for the outsiders and the teachers in your school that you're actually like a fox. You're going to go to construct some neat narrative stories about what's going on and why. And we see that as the constant balancing act that you have to achieve as a leader. You're constantly having to balance things like trying to achieve order and alignment in the school in some respects versus actually in other places allowing diversity and allowing disorder to flourish. And this is ultimately a very complicated thing to do. And as a leader, we think there's probably two different ways you improve your schools. A lot of the time, the way you're improving is just with these small, discrete ideas of things you need to do and to improve your school. If you think, for example, that transitions between lessons are taking too long and reducing time on task, that's an example of a discrete thing that you can improve. Easy to change, they have to be. Easy for teachers to learn how to do and therefore stick to. There have to be measurable feedback loops. In other words, you can tell people to do it and then you need to be able to see whether it's working or not. If there's large-scale change that's needed in your school, well, you just need to recognise how messy and how complex it is. You have to recognise how difficult it's going to be to get teachers to go on the journey for you. You need to take your time. You need to plan for failure because it will happen. And you need to allow policy changes to evolve and not assume that what you try to do is going to be correct first time round.
Fantastic. And I feel like we've kind of gone into the next question as well there, Becky, in terms of, you know, at the end of the book, you kind of pull everything together and there's some suggestions for the reader to go forward with. And one of your conclusions is that it might not be possible to tame the educational beast, but we may at least learn to live with it. So obviously you've come with some of those conclusions there, but have you got any more of those conclusions or how are they plausible as well?
Yeah, I mean, so we end up talking about an educational beast because just before writing the book, I'd read the autobiography of James Lovelock, who had written about the Gaia hypothesis, which postulates that the Earth functions as a self-regulating system. So almost every call with Ben and Matt we'd have during the 18 months of writing this, I would just keep saying, but this is just like Gaia. You know, we're living within this beast, within this system, which almost has a life of its own. And it's a helpful metaphor in a way, because it understands, you know, how we feel within the education system with our relationship to it. You know, the education system constantly evolves and is adaptive to those of us working inside it. It explains why the system also appears to push back at times against attempts to reform it. And it explains why things emerge that sometimes seem inefficient, but actually they have a function for the people who are within the system. We also think that if we think of the school system as a creature, we might learn to steer the system more successfully, working with the system rather than against it, by becoming attuned to our creature's kind of biological rhythms and systems. And we might come to terms with, at times, the impotence and the unknowledge by recognizing the limits of our control and insight. We might also feel strengthened that we're part of an entity with spirit and energy, than to imagine ourselves as part of some sort of cog in an educational machine. So we just really think, and this is, you know, quite a tough message in the book, but really just recognizing our unknowledge, the terrain of what we don't know, and becoming comfortable with that, will make our efforts to understand schooling more productive, and actually our decisions wiser as a result. And we may, on a personal level, kind of reduce the strain and the dissonance that we feel when the naive maps that we sometimes hold of what the schooling system is clash with the complex reality of the schools that we're inhabiting. And we can seek to avoid acting upon naive ideas about what schools are and what they can achieve. And we can dampen our temptation to misdiagnose the nature of the problems that we face. And we might feel better equipped to tackle some problems. And we just think we should not be cowed by the complexity of what we're being asked to do. You know, improving schools is hard, so why pretend otherwise?
Absolutely. And just in terms of just a reminder for the listeners. So the book is The Next Big Thing in School Improvement. And this is a book that I went out and bought over half term, Beckett. And I tell you what, I read it all the way through, and I listened to your podcast with The Key as well, where you had yourself and Matthew and Ben were all on that podcast. And I recommend that to listeners as well. But it's a hugely important book. And as I said earlier on, you know, for somebody who's kind of moved into a new school in a senior role and have to live through what we've had to live through for 18 months, you've almost felt as if you're restarting that kind of leadership journey from September onwards, when we, you know, hesitate to say at time of recording, you know, we're still in a normal school environment. But it's hugely important to kind of get those perspectives from people who write, from obviously yourselves who've written the book, about what kind of things that we need to bear in mind. And I just felt hugely reassured when I'd read that, and just thought, you know, what kind of things that we're doing, what kind of differences we're making, and how complex it is. But there was a lot of suggestions in the book of things that you can do. And I've written, you know, copious notes and lots of things that I can take in and hopefully, you know, use once I get back to school.
Oh, thank you for those kind words. I mean, we really enjoyed writing this book together. And so we hope that people will find it interesting and thought-provoking.
They absolutely will. So just a last point, Becky, if you don't mind, can you just signpost listeners to where they can find out more in terms of where the book's available, a little bit more about you and the projects that you're involved in, and any events that you've got coming up?
Yeah, I mean, so, well, the book is available on the John Catt website and obviously on Amazon and all the usual places. I believe the Kindle version is out now too. You can find out more about me, well, on the TeacherTap website. If you Google Teacher Tap, which has got two P's, you'll find our website, or you can download our app to learn more about that. In terms of speaking at conferences, I know that between us at the moment, we've signed up to speak at almost every single research ed conference that's coming up over the next year. One of the three of us will be there. We're really excited about doing that. We're really hopeful that as many can go ahead as possible, because seeing teachers and getting to meet people again in real life has been wonderful, and long may it continue.
Absolutely. And a reminder there for Simon Cox, if he's listening, you know, it must surely be time for Research Head Blackpool to make a comeback. I will be getting in touch with him. So I know I've said it in public, Becky, it'll have to happen at some point, won't it?
It will.
Okay, just remains to say, Becky, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. It's a great book. So it's the next big thing in school improvement. It's a John Capp publication and it's out everywhere now. Thank you, Becky.
Thanks, Phil.
Nimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.